original dramas became more and more infrequent. CBS Playhouse 90 was among the last to depart, finished off in the ratings by ABC's Untouchables. The gangbusters drama, one critic observed, caused more than a 50% decline in Playhouse 90's total audience. Anthologies all but disappeared. 5 years ago, Eric Barnow remarked in 1961, television said to the writer, write us a play. There were in the mid-50s at least a dozen television series which invited the writer to submit plays without imposing specific formulas. The play was the thing. The sign had been put away. Today, there is really no reason for any new writer to turn to television.
Original plays, anthologies on commercial television. It may sound like another world, but it was the landscape of American television in the 1950s. What happened? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
In the late 40s and into the 50s, as television antennas sprouted across the country like dandelions, who decided what Americans would see on those flickering black and white screens? What made television different from radio and films? And why did it change so dramatically during the late 50s? Those are some of the questions we'll be posing to our guest, James Boffman. He's professor and director of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of The Republic of Mass Culture, Journalism, Filmmaking, and Broadcasting in America Since 1941, also of Henry R. Luce and the Rise of the American News Media, both published by the Johns Hopkins University Press, and his latest book is Same Time, Same Station, Creating American Television, 1948 to 1961, published in 2007, also by the Johns Hopkins University Press.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Before we talk about the period of time of your book, American Television at its creation, 1948 to 1961, let's talk about today and the fact that if you turn on a television set today, you have such an incredible array of stations. You have game shows. You have American Idol survival kind of shows. When you went back to the period that you're talking about at the beginning and then you compare it to now, does it seem inevitable that we end up here?
I don't know if anything's inevitable. I think what we have to remember is so much of the 1950s, not just regarding television, but in many other areas, involved the absence of choices. And that we, in most American viewing areas, as they were called, and it's called still, you might have three channels to choose from if you were lucky. And in some markets like Pittsburgh, there was only one channel available. Most Americans wanted to have a television and purchased one with surprising speed, often regardless of income. But there are parallels in the sense that there's a tremendous variance in the programming on TV today, just as there was in the 1950s. The difference being if you could try to imagine that variance all being on one channel or being combined into two channels rather than 56 or 75 or however many your cable provider offers you.
There was a tremendous need for programming in the early years, just as there is now, though. I mean, any given channel would have to come up with a vast amount of material. So wasn't it inevitable that not all of it was going to be first-run dramas and top-rate stuff?
No, absolutely. I don't think anyone was under any illusions about that. You do need to understand a couple things. If there were attempts to do original drama or news programming, it was understood that these would come in dedicated segments, Sunday afternoons or certain hours in the evening, and not at other times. One of the first things you notice when you look at an old TV schedule, which I did with some frequency for this book, is how much time stations weren't on the air, particularly in the early going. Look at the Los Angeles Times in 1950 and look at the, you know, LA at that moment had, I think, six stations. How much of it was dead time? They were showing the test pattern. So you're right that a lot of the programming as a whole was not necessarily to be honored, but it was filler. One of the reasons several of the networks aired congressional hearings, including ones involving Senator Joseph McCarthy.
Gavel to gavel.
One of the reasons they did it was because it filled the afternoon. And that wasn't the only reason. There was some altruism involved. And ABC, the network in question, still lost money doing it. But it was filler. I mean, that's one of the reasons Ted Turner bought the Atlanta Braves. He was supposed to fill his station. So Channel 17 in Atlanta.
You write, I think it's at the beginning of your second chapter, that radio is the mother of television. Can you talk about the extent to which television's nature, it's the characteristics that it took on, are a result of what was already there on radio?
Well, I should credit that quote to Tallulah Bankhead, who a few listeners will remember. Extremely colorful, shall we say.
Salty.
Salty and character. And we'd probably have to close the network down if I started sharing Tallulah Bankhead stories, which may be true. It was the mother of television in two ways. First of all, the major players, the architects of television, almost all came from radio. And so they came to television with radio's rules, practices, assumptions. That was point number one. And radio, by definition, was a natural model for much of television because you had the same need as you both do to fill hours. And a need that the movie industry didn't quite understand when it finally did enter. Elements of the movie industry began to become involved in serious production. And because a lot of television was live, a lot of the practices and the sort of assumptions from radio were easily transferred. It's an interesting hypothetical. It almost happened. What would have occurred if a major Hollywood studio had bought ABC? And that almost occurred in the late 1940s. And then that studio committed major resources, which was a second commitment. Maybe television wouldn't have been the child of radio.
When you think of the amount of film produced in the country in the 30s and 40s compared to the amount of television, just in terms of hours, the movie industry would have had its hands full.
Absolutely.
Again, still filling those hours. One of the things that fascinates me about television is particularly the way you detail its origins is how early people were watching television. We're talking about people actually watching television in the 30s to some extent on a regular basis rather than that post-World War II boom, which we always think
of.
Well,
there were small numbers who were. I should say maybe I was unclear. Television sets went on sale in 1939, and RCA, which was one of several manufacturers promoting TVs, heavily publicized the technology and people, and they also gave a television to President Roosevelt, which you can see at Hyde Park. In fact, I had to explain to one of the guards because I'd seen the letters, "Dear Mr. President, here's your, here's your TV." But the TV marketing in 39-40 didn't take off for a number of reasons, and the main one being price. Television receivers were very expensive. It was the tail end of the Depression, but they were still an expensive commodity. And then there was concern over frequency and would I be buying something that would be obsolescent, sort of what some listeners are going through
now. With
HD. You've tried to buy a TV, and I'm sure you regularly go out to do that. Now the big issue is high definition and what that means. And
won't it be better next year and cheaper?
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about the big three, the ABC, CBS, NBC, because a lot of your book does focus on the personalities, particularly of NBC and CBS directors and how that shaped things. Coming from radio to television, how did those networks carry over?
Well, first of all, ABC was so far behind during most of this period, it really isn't important. The rivalry fundamentally involved CBS and NBC. In the 50s. And I wouldn't say it's so much personalities as programming philosophies were very different. Personality-wise, I don't think any of us would want to go camping with the owner of CBS. William Paley was a very cold fish, a brilliant, very calculating man. But Paley's people were very careful. They didn't have a lot of money to invest in the new medium. So they chose the risk-averse strategy. They plotted CBS television to resemble CBS radio in many, many ways and were very calculating about it, very cheap, but in ways that I don't think the viewer noticed at the time. NBC, in contrast, was a subsidiary of RCA, which was then the nation's leading or one of the nation's leading electronics makers. And NBC didn't have the same budget restraints. They had more money to spend because NBC was promoting a product that RCA was manufacturing, that is televisions. And NBC spent a lot more. And also philosophically, NBC, under Pat Weaver, who became sort of head of television operations in 1949, increasingly promoted the idea of a much riskier programming strategy, which was more specials, more risk-taking generally. And even as the evidence began to mount that CBS's strategy, which was to invest more in 30-minute situation comedies, occasional action drama, 60 minutes, was paying off. That's really what, particularly as the audience grew and spread into smaller cities and towns, the kind of big city tastes that Weaver and his circle liked, which could run the gamut from Milton Berle, Texaco Star Theater, to the live dramas that you've referenced, to opera on Sunday afternoons, that audience as a percent of the audience nationally was shrinking.
And because of the addition of these people who were from outside the New York area or the drama capitals.
Not just New York, but Chicago, Los Angeles. And, you know, I was talking to some students about this the other day. Television was more integrated in 1949, racially, than it was in 1957.
You mean in terms of casting?
In terms of race, in terms of the presence of blacks, for instance. It's a very slight difference, but it's noticeable. And I would argue the sort of assumption some people might make is that, well, there must have been a terrible class bias to who bought TVs, and it must have been a lot of rich folk.
But you mentioned that people were buying whether they could afford them or not,
absolutely.
Which we still see.
It's always good to be quoted on your own on your own show, and I'm glad you were listening. I wish my students had that characteristic. What you find, in fact, is there's a tremendous locational bias. In other words, TV's diffusion occurred where there was television service. In other words, in New York City was a huge, hugely disproportionate marker of the TV market. Washington, D.C., Cleveland, near where I grew up. And those markets were the first where people would buy TV. You weren't going to buy a TV in Arkansas because you couldn't get it.
Yes,
you know,
it was limited with the reception.
Unless you were near Memphis, you couldn't get a station sort of thing. But the bigger city markets, I argue, were more receptive to live drama because they were more interested in the theatrical than, for example, when television reaches smaller markets, there's resistance to these highfalutin dramas and so forth and to Milton Berle, who is too New York, who is, you know, just too brash.
But I Love Lucy, on the other hand, which is very New York-y and yet somehow transcended all of that.
That's the anomaly here. Now, I would say that Lucy herself is sort of the American everywoman. But CBS sweated big time over the casting of Desi Arnaz as the husband, and they originally didn't want him to play the husband because it was considered too daring
to have a Cuban
playing that, you know, playing her husband, even though he was her husband. But Ball was able to, in effect, force CBS's hand and say, no Desi, no Lucy, and you have to cast him in this role. But you're absolutely right that is the great exception. But I might point out the Goldbergs, which had been a very popular radio program, eventually bombed on TV, couldn't sustain its audience. And I would argue that the kind of Jewish urban culture that the Goldbergs portrayed was just too alien to people in smaller cities and towns. And I'm not accusing the audience of anti-Semitism or hostility to Jews. It was just foreign to them. They just didn't understand it.
I haven't seen the Goldbergs, and oddly enough, I haven't heard the Goldbergs on radio either. But don't you suppose that the charisma, the sheer charisma and television quality of those faces of Lucy and Desi had something to do? I mean, those were faces for television, big reactions, immediate reactions.
Hey, Babalu. Yeah.
Yes. And a lot of it had to do with the difference between the writing and the characters.
Absolutely. And again, I don't need to cast off on the negatives here. You know, why did the Goldbergs fail and Lucy and Desi succeed? But something I've written about, another connection, and I think I shared this with you some time ago, Norm, was why did Jack Benny prove to have legs on television, who's a Jewish guy from Waukegan, Illinois, and Berle did not? And I think it's because Benny was the assimilationist.
Yes.
He didn't, you know, Benny could have been your next door neighbor. And Benny
and the
never.
Jewish, the whole Jewishness of Benny, though, was, I mean, he
never,
celebrated Christmas every year on
absolutely.
The show and made a big deal out of Christmas
show. And the irony of irony, even though he is tight-fisted, that was not associated with his being Jewish.
Exactly.
You know, whereas Burl, it would have been. And the other thing, and Emily, you're going to love this. I've read a lot of Milton Berle scripts. Don't do it. No. But I still find I may be the only person in this zip code. I find Burl funny. I still laugh when I see bits he did. But even when they tried to make the show less New York, it's still New York. It's still the references, and not just to New York proper, but to Jewish culture and stuff. And they tried to – he was ordered to tone that down, and it was still too New York. Whereas if you watch a Benny show from the early 50s, it could have been anywhere.
Well, I have a question for you about the – because you're talking about whether a show failed or not. At this point in the early days of television, how are they figuring out numbers, and to what extent are the advertisers the ones that are calling the shots?
No, it's a great question, and there are rating services. Now, they're not as good as they are now, but they're rating services that were being done from the beginning of the medium. Some of the earliest evidence in the trade publications is the funniest, where the advertisers based it on whether people were coming into the showroom or not, or asking for a product. There was even a Good Humor campaign, the ice cream thing, and that they noticed after doing some TV advertising that they were getting more business, because in big cities you could get a card you would put in your window saying you wanted the Good Humor man to come up. You know, things. So they had the kind of anecdotal evidence. But there were rating services from the beginning, and they had a pretty good idea what people were watching. Now, what they didn't know were the demographics. That's something that they will learn later.
And which were changing, I gather, pretty quickly anyway, as these stations go out into the countryside.
And that will change over time. There is an interesting perceptual problem in some agencies, some ad agencies, and among some advertisers. Many of them think TV viewers are more well-to-do than they really were. And they don't get it. They don't understand that, no, this is a mass medium. This is a medium that's appealing to a lot of people. And the example that I used near the beginning for many parents, most parents, was we've got two kids and here's a babysitter. Here's a distraction. While my mother prepared her famous city chicken. Little Melty and Jim can watch. Don't ask for the recipe, believe me. My brother and I still cringe. But, you know, here's a distraction for you.
And it was safe, unlike today's rather porous prohibitions.
Right.
I mean, a lot of it may have been stupid or over their heads, but it was safe.
And there were a lot of the kids' programming, and some of this is available, by the way. The Senate investigated the juvenile delinquency scare of the mid-50s, which in retrospect is, you know, in the light of things like VodTech and everything, is just silly that there was all this panic about juvenile delinquency. But stations willingly surrendered program logs, transcripts in some cases of programs, and I was able to read some of those in Washington. And I watched some of these kid shows later in the decade, and you forget not only how tame they were, but how they would include moral lessons.
Oh, sometimes rather heavily.
Behavioral lessons, you know. And there may be I look at you, Norm, because you had a television as a child, unlike Emily, but there was a really characteristically dumb Abbott and Costello routine where you may remember there was this cop who was always on the show, who was a cast member, and something awful happened to him, a bag of flour held on his head, or he got squirted. But at the end of the show, you may remember, Abbott Costello would come on in front of the curtain and just say goodbye. And they both went out of their way to say, now, you kids remember the police officer as a symbol of authority. In other words, you know, we just did this to this poor cast member. But, you know, you look at it now, you realize they were very self-conscious about behavior and reinforcing norms, howdy doody, giving citizenship lessons during the 48 campaign.
Well, you know, the other extreme that you mention in the book, Jim, Alfred Hitchcock, who, you know, you go through the half hour of lighthearted or indifferent, cold, calculating murder.
Yes.
And this is just the way things are, you know. This is not a sense of kind of good or bad in this.
Right.
And then Alfred Hitchcock comes on at the end of the show and says, oh, by the way, she tried it again and it didn't work so well the second time.
Well, I have to say, and I watched some of the Hitchcock shows. I was fairly young and I think ordered to bed when they came on. But it was a New York Times essay that sort of reminded me of this, that he would always, if there was any hint at the end of the show that the murderer might get away with it, he would come on at the end and sort of explain, and he caught it.
We haven't talked about news on television. We'll do that when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Radio Waves is Wisconsin Public Radio's e-newsletter. Sign up and you'll receive a monthly email with what's happening at WPR. A subscription to Radio Waves is free, and getting it is simple. Just go to WPR.org.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, James Boffman. He is the author of Same Time, Same Station, Creating American Television, 1948 to 1961. We've talked about the big famous shows, network-produced shows, especially by CBS and NBC. But weren't local TV stations actually required to provide some local programming?
Yes.
And how did they manage to do that with the TV being so expensive to produce? What did they actually produce?
Well, they did a couple things. And there was an FCC rule still somewhat in effect called Local Live. And the idea was that you would originate programming from your station. You could be a network affiliate. But the understanding was that although it was never – the FCC never said what percent of your schedule, but there was still this understanding that a percent of your schedule, unspecified, would go to local originations. What stations did, although they didn't all do this initially, is they would offer 15-minute newscasts. They would offer religious programming sometimes on Sunday mornings, nothing very extensive, nothing very fancy, and in many cases children's programs. Connecticut Station had its own cooking show and so forth.
All of those sound pretty low budget.
Right. Cleveland, where I grew up, and I gather Milwaukee had this as well. There would be polka shows to play to certain ethnic groups. They didn't, as some radio stations had, to my knowledge, offer. I think some of the New York stations may have had programs for African Americans, but by and large that was not an expectation. These shows were denoted by their cheapness. They were live. In Charlotte, North Carolina, there was a guy who hosted the Kitty Show who was also the weatherman, if you could imagine that, and be jumping. And he was probably making nothing at the time. He was probably horribly underpaid, as a lot of TV people then were. A lot of station people were.
One of the controversial areas today has to do with the extent to which news is entertainment or where news is being controlled politically, like, say, with Fox News. If you look back at the early time here in the 1950s and the news on television, was it a lot better then?
Well, it was much more serious to the point of being dull. And the notion of infotainment that we have now was still pretty much the province of newspapers, of big city newspapers, of gossip magazines that flourished in the 50s. And most television people couldn't imagine that kind of reporting as news. Now, is it because they were noble in ways that we are not, that this generation of people were blessed or something like that? Well, there's a couple things. One is there was always this element that news was supposed to be serious, and this was partly because broadcasters were anxious to establish their credibility as a news source. Newspapers still regarded themselves, newspaper reporters and editors still regarded themselves as the superior medium. And so you wanted to establish people like Murrow and others, we're just as good as you are, even though we have to wear makeup, this sort of thing. The second thing is the Cold War is at its height during this period. When you go over the Historical Society and look at the NBC collections and you're leafing through these just memo after memo after memo about everything. Because I think if someone wanted to go to the bathroom at NBC, she had to file a memo. And then you see these very casually meetings, what we will do in the event New York is hit by a nuclear attack. What planning – this is in the early 50s. What you forget that during the Korean War, there was casual – it was just assumed among many opinion leaders that was going to bubble into something worse. And that Truman himself did talk about – the use of nuclear weapons to scare the living daylights out of the Brits and so forth during the Korean War. So I think the Cold War concentrated, to borrow from Dr. Johnson, the Cold War concentrated the mind wonderfully and made news. But it also had the effect of making news rather dull, rather like that sermon you could have skipped.
Was there the same discussion of, you know, was the anchorman handsome? Was there – it seems to me when I look back at least what I've read is it doesn't seem as if there's the same emphasis on the superficial appearance of the people giving the news or
– I would ask Norma what his memories are. The earliest memories I have of watching like the TV newscasters in Cleveland, which the stations we watched and – were that these were sort of stolid-looking people.
Yes.
These weren't matinee idols. I remember I believe in they Channel 5 in Cleveland had this guy named Tom Fields who was treated as sort of a papal figure in Cleveland. But women didn't, I think, whistle when he walked down Euclid Avenue or anything like that. He wasn't you know, like what's his name, Williams, a pretty boy.
I think you were still coming off or still in the final years of that more paternalistic approach toward broadcasting. If you look at the commercials, they were also, we're telling you the way it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And the evidence wasn't on the messenger. It was on the message.
A lot of what you're talking about, though, infotainment and filtering into news and then anchors starting to look like mannequins derives from the fact that only in the middle late 60s do advertisers begin to realize TV newscasts are worth buying, sponsoring. NBC and CBS both made money on their newscasts, but for instance, locally, they weren't big revenue generators. But then once they figured out this is a way to make money, that's when they began to say, well, you know, we could make even more money if we brought human attributes to Barbie and Ken. And then we could really roll in the dough and we could draw even more viewers with that. We would draw the marginal viewer, the one who was going to watch a rerun on another channel but might watch it if we had this eye candy, male or female eye candy on the air. And so you've got that phenomenon. And then, of course, the agenda. You know, if we loosen the agenda up and do a lot of shows on health or, you know, a lot of features on health or about this or that, viewers will appreciate that. And they'll watch us. We'll make even more money.
Speaking of the sponsor in radio prior to television, the sponsor really was supreme in controlling the news content. In other words, December 7, 1941, we're not going to have a lot of news bulletins during the Jack Benny program because the sponsor was in effect controlling how that show was going to be handled on the air, wasn't it? I mean, you had much less news on radio prior to television coming.
Well, along. I might argue with you a little bit about that. For example, the Munich crisis in 1938, when Germany, France, and Britain argued over the fate of Czechoslovakia, and it looked like World War II was going to begin then, two of the networks did, in fact, give up significant amounts of airtime. And by the way, Paley at CBS didn't want to do it at first, but then NBC did it and then he felt he had to follow. So I know what you mean that I gather one thing about Pearl Harbor is it didn't they didn't interrupt programming the way people in retrospect assumed it would have. But there was a lot of news programming in the early part of the war. Much of it did have advertiser interest. But I don't think the advertiser control over news was nearly as great as it was over entertainment. Part of that because a lot of news programming was sustaining at that time. It went unadvertised. Part of it was a lot of advertiser programming of news was benevolent. We're going to sponsor this as a public service.
And there weren't conflicts between the news that was being covered and stories that might go against the grain.
Oh, I'm not saying that never occurred. It did occur. Now you're dragging me back to radio, now, right? This is a plot.
Well,
on your
we're
part.
TV too, though.
You know, no, you don't care about TV. I know that's all you care
it's
about.
Just radio,
radio
with pictures. But
yeah, yeah.
That aside.
But no, there were episodes, and David Culbert at Louisiana State has written about some involving radio commentators who criticized the Roosevelt administration, and there's some evidence that the Roosevelt administration got wind of that. Put pressure on a sponsor to put pressure on the commentator. And so that did occur. The Roosevelt Library, by the way, you go up there and you look at some of this correspondence, it's a different world in the sense that you do see, in some cases, handwritten notes from FDR who's terrified that one of the radio networks, ABC, what became ABC, will be bought by Colonel McCormick of the Chicago Tribune. If you're FDR, that's your worst nightmare is that one of the radio networks is going to be owned by your worst journalistic adversary, you know, be sort of like stretching things. Murdoch buying the Washington Post. You know, imagine what Hillary Clinton would think of that.
One thing that interested me is reading about this period is it seems as if the stations are following rules, but the rules aren't written down. It's almost an honor code for some of it in terms of to what extent do you do some sort of educational programs and what are the rules?
Well,
at
every 3 years, you own a TV or radio station. Every 3 years in those days, your license was subject to renewal, and you had to provide the commission with evidence of your public service, what was called and still called public service programming. Again, the FCC never said 5%. I've interviewed commissioners who said that was a great mistake. We should have said 5% of your broadcast day should be dedicated to this kind of programming. But you still had to document over that three-year period what you had done. And that was one standard. But the second standard was more behavioral in another way. And that was if you ran too many commercials or you ran racing results from racetracks. And
why? Because those could be bet on?
We get you in trouble with it. I don't understand why they have this fetish about it. And, of course, if you were accused of immoral programming, if you turned on a channel in Rockford and suddenly saw nude dancing, you know what I'm getting at is that a lot of the rules were unstated, and a lot of them had to do with sort of what were considered to be the prevailing moral norms in mid-century America. And some of them were prudish, some of them weren't. Some of them, you have parents, you sort of would like to have those rules brought back, it's sort of the understanding. The FCC rarely, if ever, revoked a license. It just never did it. But it was always sort of there in the background, often laughed at and so forth. But in fact, the networks and stations understood that the FCC was a sort of old dog that looked like it was harmless but still had its teeth.
Mm-hmm. One interesting figure in your book for me that you've touched on a little bit but I was going to ask you to say more about is Weaver of NBC because you get the sense that he had a different vision.
Weaver was not alone in the following. He thought that radio, the network radio and Hollywood, the motion picture industry, both industries had lost audience in the late 1940s because they had gotten too risk-averse. They were, in a sense, dumbing down their product. One of his arguments about Hollywood, which was not illogical, was that Hollywood was over-attending to the teenage and young adult consumer. And that's probably a feeling you two share when you try to figure out a movie you want to go to see. And you're going, who's Adam Sandler? This sort of issue. But that was one assumption. He'd made a similar argument about radio, that radio had gotten – network radio had gotten too conservative in the sense that it was one sitcom after another and so forth. And it wasn't just that Weaver thinking that. I mean, critics like John Crosby, who was the great TV critic for the late, great Herald Tribune, was saying that. Jack Gould, the New York Times, was saying that. Irving Howe was saying something else. Post-war America is going to be different. And in the post-war world, Americans, for a variety of reasons, are going to want more of their mass culture. They won't want it to be as it was during the war or before the war. They want it to be more daring. Americans are going to be smarter. They're going to be more demanding, blah, blah, blah.
Now, well, for all, there were more college-educated people out there.
Right.
A reasonable assumption.
It was a very reasonable assumption. The problem was, in terms of management theory, is to what extent was TV, in fact, a new industry? To what extent would it require new rules? And CBS gambled, partly because it didn't have the resources that NBC did, is, well, you know, Weaver could be right. And they did worry about Weaver for a few years, that he could be right, that the audience may be changing. But we're not going to take that risk. We'll let Weaver jump first. And if he's still alive, we'll follow him. Or we'll sort of follow him. We'll do some of the things he's doing. But we're not going to invest nearly as much because we don't have what Weaver has. And as it turned out, CBS was absolutely correct, particularly as the audience spread into smaller cities and towns. What had worked before on radio was large. Not all the shows, but what had worked before, the genre would work again. And the same held to the film industry that again, Weaver was wrong in the sense that a lot of what he identified as declining audience demand was being driven by other factors that had nothing to do with content. A lot of the reasons Hollywood lost audience after World War II was because people like my parents got married and didn't go to the movies anymore, partly because they could never agree on what to go see. I gather, you know, things like that, that they were starting families and so they didn't go to the films. But Weaver was a brilliant, brilliant man. But in retrospect, you can see that, you know, the sets of assumptions he made were suspect. Some of them were quite noble and quite – you look back now, boy, that's interesting that he assumed that. But
well, I guess there were – I'm not sure what actually motivated, but I gather there were some efforts to have both. In other words, to have something that was – had mass appeal and yet had some – validity in the writing and in the ideas and in the the actors that were brought into the project. I mean, Rod Serling comes to mind, the earlier Rod Serling in particular, but certainly by the time you get into the Twilight Zone, he was trying hard. How successful was that effort to bring in numbers?
Bring in numbers of viewers? Or, well, I think Serling actually developed a fairly good track record, although it's interesting, Twilight Zone was never as popular on the air as it was in syndication.
This was like one of those Star Trek phenomenons.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was one of those, by the way, when Star Trek was in danger of cancellation in 66, whatever, who wrote NBC. I used to impress students with that, but now they go Star Trek. You know,
the wheel keeps turning.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't like it.
You don't like it.
But Serling, I think, was, you know, didn't, and same with Patachewski. You know, I think was very well regarded and had his admirers, but was never as popular. I thought you were going to actually ask me something else, because one of the things that Weaver promoted, and that you would also see this in Ed Sullivan's show, was the what I call mixing it up. So you'd have
Beverly Sills next to the juggler,
right? Mm-hmm. You'd have, or my favorite line, it was Charlton Heston read the Lord's Prayer in this very dramatic, you know. And I believe Sullivan said the following when they finished, well, thank you, Chuck Huston, and let's hear it for the Lord's Prayer. You know, ask for a round of applause.
If he didn't, he probably should have to be Ed Sullivan.
And things like that would go on. And the idea was, and sort of the analogy might be Jay Leno, The Tonight Show, or David Letterman's show, where you would have a mix. You'd have a character from Survivor or, you know, American Idol. And then you'd bring on Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Yes. Talk about history.
You know, and something like that. And this was very typical, I think, of very self-conscious. And the analogy that hit me, having written on the publication, was Life magazine in the 50s. It was the same way. Bathing suits, Toulouse-Lautrec. Women swimming in the Mediterranean. The novels of Balzac. You know, I mean, this very self-conscious, we're going to educate people, but we're also going to give them pretty pictures.
Well, the overall schedule, I guess, was a lot like that too, of going from program to program. They didn't seem to worry as much as stations do now about continuity of appeal from one show to the next.
In his memoir, Weaver talked about programming, putting a variety show on at 8 or 9 Central, and then at 10 you'd have drama on. The assumption being kids would go to bed and they wouldn't – and I can remember this. Most drama didn't – I wouldn't want to watch an original drama when I was a kid, unless it was something like, you know, some action drama. Then I would, you know. But CBS mixed it up a bit. But there were these assumptions that after 10 o'clock Eastern, that was when you could get real serious and you didn't worry about audience flow.
What about the percentage given over to sports?
It actually declines over this period, except at local stations, which carry the games. You know, baseball particularly.
You didn't really have football yet at this point.
Well,
as a major player,
college football was quite popular in the 50s. The NFL is still finding an audience. By the way, there's a great myth that the 58 Giants-Colts game created this tremendous interest in the NFL. That is really – I gather that was Haversham's last project, and but before his untimely death. But baseball is still the leading player, and baseball is – again, some of your listeners will remember this, how dull a telecast of a baseball game was. Now, it was a great marketing ploy. The World Series, people didn't care. It was a World Series. And what I noticed when TV came to Detroit, for instance, TV service, when the Detroit station was connected to NBC, the retailers were all saying, see the World Series, buy a television, because that's how important the World Series was then as opposed to now. Of course, I attribute all this to the decline of America being a baseball fan. The country was better off when baseball reigned. But sports actually fell as a network commodity over time. It was very important to stations. And this may have been what you ask. Sunday programming was not, with some exception, given over to sports. It was given over to culture and news. On Saturday, you had games being televised, but I think you and I and Emily could have sponsored some of these shows. They were so I've seen some of the contracts, how inexpensive they were. I had a chance to show through a colleague, Pat Richter, what the NCAA contract looked like for college sports in 1954. And it was just, again, it was with our allowance in 1954, we probably could have.
Kind of looked that way too, didn't it?
Yeah.
Was it really a golden age? We'll maybe get some insights into that in just a moment. This is University of the Air.
Stay current on the topics of discussion on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Visit us online at WPR.org and sign up for the Ideas program notes. We'll keep you updated and informed online at WPR.org.
I'll teach you.
Oh, how lovely to fly!
I'll teach you how to jump on the wind's back, and away we'll go. Wendy, when you're sleeping in your silly bed, you might be flying about with me, saying funny things to the stars.
How do you do it?
You just think lovely, wonderful thoughts, and up you'll go.
Oh, how sweet!
I'm sweet. I'm sweet. I'm flying. Look at me, way up high, suddenly, here am I, I'm flying. I'm flying.
Flying, flying, flying.
I can soar, I can weave, and what's more, I'm not even trying.
That's from The Peter Pan Show, which aired on television in 1955 with Mary Martin as Peter Pan. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is James Boffman, whose book is called Same Time, Same Station, Creating American Television, 1948 to 1961. Well, tell us about Peter Pan. What kind of impact did that have on television?
Well, it was the most successful of a type of program that Weaver championed at NBC, which was called The Spectacular, which was live, often theatrical productions. It was heavily promoted by NBC. We often notice today how much cross-promotion takes place, ESPN and elsewhere, of programs. NBC took second place to no one in 1955 in terms of getting people to watch it. Huge audience share. I mean, in the 70s. It's something you die for now. And very well received. It also was a show that was recorded, eventually videotaped, which you actually heard was a 1960 production of the original production that was videotaped. That one was videotaped. But it was a show you could watch if you were a kid again and again and again, as I did sort of when it was be rebroadcast. I would watch it as a little kid. And then, of course, I grew out of it and started watching Combat and stuff like that.
And was the idea to get Broadway into American living rooms?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Weaver operated from a simple had a series of assumptions. One was that the reason Americans, you know, didn't like this kind of program, they'd never seen it before. And he was sure if you shared this kind of – this is where in many ways Pat was a cultural Democrat. If you show them this kind of programming, which we now realize wasn't like, you know, it was a very middle-brow product he's sharing with the American people. Is, you know, he's not, you know, doing King Lear or something like that, you know, and unedited. But he was convinced that people just were exposed to it. And in that moment, it looked like he was right. And it sent just shockwaves in the industry because maybe Weaver is correct. Maybe he knows the future.
But it didn't play out so well. And as we said at the beginning of the hour, fairly quickly, I guess, all of those anthologies and the original dramas and the other theatrical productions were dinosaurs.
Right. Well, Weaver only deserves credit or blame for The Spectacular, for shows like – productions like Peter Pan. The anthologies preceded him, Kraft Television Theater and so forth, and Armstrong Circle Theater. What was happening was a lot of them had been made on the cheap. They'd never been as good as they could have been. You see this in the memoranda and stuff and so forth. But what really killed him off was – that ABC in particular began to program eventually very well done westerns and detective shows that more closely resembled the Hollywood product, that Americans had embraced in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And given a choice between that sort of predictable, you know, like 77 Sunset Strip show like that and a you didn't have product predictability with an original drama because it just might be as many of them were terribly depressing.
that was taking place in a kitchen.
Now, they tried to up the ante. There was a TV production of The Sinking of the Titanic, and I remember. There was a TV production of For Whom the Bell Tolls with Jason Robards, which Hemingway thought was better than the feature film, which may or may not do anything for listeners. But the Hemingway was genuinely impressed by. But by and large, what was happening was that ABC in particular, to a lesser extent CBS, was providing film programming that was appealing particularly, I think, to this smaller city and town American who, you know, who said, this is New York stuff, doesn't do anything for me. I don't like New York and this is – this is the kind of product I would actually go to see.
Did the film stuff – I mean, there were some interesting examples of – well, Westerns in particular, and I think I Love Lucy too, was filmed.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So that the big advantage was they could be rerun in syndication endlessly, and they looked sharp and crisp. And in fact, even when color TV came along, something like The Cisco Kid had it made because it was been filmed in color.
Well, and Zorro was in color. Disney, that was a Walt Disney production, and he insisted. Disney was a spendthrift in these matters. But the original contract, which I have seen for I Love Lucy, specified it would be broadcast live from New York.
So, wasn't it Desi Arnaz who insisted that it was going to be filmed?
No, what happened is they both wanted it filmed for a variety of reasons we don't need to get into. But here was the problem. What most people, not everybody, but most people on the broadcast and the production side underestimated was the demand and the resilience of the film product. People didn't realize that audiences would watch again an episode of a show they enjoyed or that people would miss it and then, you know, see it again. And when Desi Arnaz reluctantly agreed, when the contract was put together with Arnaz and Ball, Arnaz assumed ownership of the series. CBS didn't think it held any value.
Because people wouldn't want to watch the reruns.
Yeah. And Arnaz thought, well, I could sell this in Cuba.
Is that where
he thought the film residuals would be sold overseas, that that's where he would get his return back. This is 1951-52 when this is all going on. Now, the problem in our field is, you know, say, you know, mass culture history or whatever it is I do, is a lot of people say, well, everybody knew. Well, no, everybody didn't know. And by the way, network affiliates were very nervous about reruns because they assumed if we rerun a show, people will go, well, I've already seen this. What's on CBS or what's on NBC?
A reasonable assumption.
Or I'm going to go out and mow the lawn, you know, and stuff like that. So a lot of this is in play. I mean, a lot of this is not knowing.
One other genre you talk about in your book is the game show, the quiz show, including the cheating that went on. Can you give us some sense of the history of the game show on TV?
Well, what Lou Cowan and others came up with was essentially taking a radio concept, which Norman knows about, which was a very popular genre, but raising the stakes, the prize money, so you could make $64,000. And that was you could get a Cadillac when a Cadillac was something you wanted.
That's how Joyce Brothers became famous, winning on that show.
Absolutely. And there were some other things going on. One was to cast really interesting contestants. Unlike, you know, the Millionaire Show of a few years ago, we thought or viewers thought that these people really did know about Shakespeare or Brothers category. Was it sports or something that she was coming on to do and things like that?
Right. That's right. Yeah.
And so forth. So there was this – and there was no multiple choice. It was essay exams. So there was this tremendous excitement and personalities like – just as we're seeing personalities emerge from shows like American Idol were created out of these shows. It wasn't until late in the game that the suspicion rose that they'd been fixed and that this wasn't a coincidence. By the way, I don't normally recommend – I'm always nervous as an overly trained scholar to recommend this. But the film, Quiz Show, on the whole captures what went on very well. And there are moments in that film where I had the sensation watching it where I said, how did they know that? And how did they get that right? Just as I did watching parts of the recent Murrow movie.
You end your book by talking about the aspirations and dreams that Weaver and others shared for television and the conviction that the television audience would be different, sort of this sense of maybe unfulfilled dreams. Do you think it could have been different?
Well, I don't want that sentence to be taken as an indictment of the audience. I was told years ago by a teacher who meant a great deal to me, don't blame, you know, sort of quoting Burke, don't blame the people. Don't blame – because those of us who were TV viewers after Weaver left in 1956 didn't have any choice. You know, it was, we were choosing from the limited menu that we had to look at. I think one thing that occurs after Weaver leaves is that the networks very – two of the networks, CBS and NBC, decide to invest heavily in news programming. And this buys them enormous goodwill with two key constituencies. One are the chattering classes. TV columnists and critics really like that. So they're unhappy about some of the trends, some of the formulaic programming trends that they see. But they're very impressed by the Huntley-Brinkley report. They're very impressed by the amount of money that CBS and NBC will invest covering news, breaking news stories, and the respectful tone those stories tend to take, by the way, towards those in power. That will, of course, impress the second group, which is even more important. And those federal regulators, members of Congress. Members of Congress, by the way, during this period are much more important than members of the FCC, with a few exceptions. Members of Congress can make – if anything else can make you sweat. They can make you testify. So that's part of what happens. I think put differently, if the networks hadn't had the sense, that is CBS and NBC hadn't had the sense to make that decision, maybe there would have been more of a revolt or more of a backlash. It really doesn't happen. I mean, Newton Minow, as FCC chairman, tries to, as it were, lead a I don't want to say crusade, and Newton would be the last person to accept that, but it doesn't quite take. And people more or less are mollified. Well, I'm not happy about this, but you did air me on Meet the Press. So that makes up for a host of sins.
Thanks for guiding us through that maze of programming and the way it all changed in the 1950s and early 60s. Our guest has been James Boffman, the author of Same Time, Same Station, Creating American Television, 1948 to 1961. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. Thanks for turning off the TV long enough to listen to this hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, the story of a man who returned to China after 64 years of being away. Our story, Coming Home to China, next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air. Join us here on Wisconsin Public Radio.